Hello everyone, I'm Eve Rees.
And I'm Claire Wright.
And we are historians. If this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to season 5 of our podcast, Archive Fever, where each episode we are conducting intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians and other victims of the research bug.
We'll talk to these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating, and most illuminating experience in the archives.
And as always, we'll be asking the question, what madness is this? Well, I can't tell you how much I've been looking forward to today's interview. I've been doing a lot of preemptive giggling and practicing wiping the smile off my face so I can look like a proper serious historian. Because today in the Archive Fever hot seat, we have the marvellous Zoe Coombs-Ma. Crowd goes wild.
Hi. Hello. Thank you to everyone who's here. Thanks to the crowd. Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me.
It's so great to have you. Now, here's the bio bit. Zoe Coombs-Ma is a comedian.
True.
That's it. Oh, and she has a picture of her bare bum on her website, which consists of one page of cancelled tour dates and ends with the words, "Yes, I know this website is ridiculous." On her Twitter profile, Zoe identifies as she, her, with a they, them rising. She also identifies herself as being a petite blonde, which I can tell you, dear listeners, is patently fake news. Fortunately, Wikipedia is here to tell us that Zoe is not only a comedian but also a performer and an actor. Her 2016 Melbourne Comedy Festival trigger warning, in which Zoe plays a sexist pig who might well be your cousin, called Dave, won multiple awards, including the award previously known as Barry. In 2008, Zoe performed as a new character, Bossy Bottom, which might account for her choice of profile picture on her website. Apparently, Dave was in a coma. Zoe has performed stand-up comedy in Australia, New York, London and Edinburgh. Bossy Bottom is now a special on Amazon Prime, but today we have lured Zoe out of the television studio and into the podcast studio to talk about her recent ABC history documentary series, Queer Australia. The journalist Richard Glover has called Queer Australia the most brilliant, loving, funny, inspiring and thrillingly innovative docu-series I've seen for yonks. Zoe, welcome to Archive Fever.
Oh my God, thank you so much for having me and for that delightful introduction. I loved it. Although I think you did just pinpoint all of the problems that my management have with my online presence. I'd totally forgotten I even had a website. I should update that thing.
Well, yes, this is your consumer choice review.
I don't know if you noticed, but I don't know if you clicked through this, but if you click on gallery, it just takes you to a Google image search of Zoe Coombs-Ma.
I think that's very clever. It means you never have to update your website.
Exactly. It just does it itself.
Yeah, you're like a self-sourcing pudding.
I absolutely am. Sticky day.
Okay, first I got to get the fangirl moment over and done with. Zoe, I couldn't agree more with Richard Glover. I absolutely loved Queer Australia. Well done you and all who sail with you. Now, we're going to dig down into the hows and whys of making this deeply researched doco series. But first, I want to start with the warm-up question we ask all of our guests. You tell us in episode 1 that, I'm quoting you here, "I'm a comedian, not an historian. I'm not qualified." But you're being a little bit disingenuous, or at least self-deprecating to an extent, because you're clearly an A-grade nerd. So when did you first get bitten by the research bug?
You know, I was thinking about this on the way here, and in a lot of ways I feel like a real kind of research heathen. Like, I'm an absolute philistine. I'm not a historian. I don't have a proper research background. But I remembered, I think I was like 8 maybe. It was either my birthday or Christmas. The one thing that I wanted, that I asked for, was a history book. I think my parents must have been like, what the hell do we do with this child? Like, how do we get, and which history book also? And I think I had this sense that there would be like one book and everything would sort of be in there. So I have actually always been very much interested in history, but I can also remember getting that book and being deeply disappointed by it. It was like a complete Australian history. And I was like, but this is just Australia. What about all the other stuff? This is quite boring. What is this about Federation? This is not what I was after. I think I wanted more Egyptians and things. So I have always really been interested in history, but I suppose in terms of actual archive, I mean, in the making of Queer Australia, I didn't actually go into a lot of the archives. We spent a bit of time in Australian Queer Archives, but we had researchers who would sort of do most of the nitty-gritty of that. So my job really, and my interest is in looking at the things and how they sit next to each other and kind of creating a, not so much a story, but a picture out of that. But a lot of my first interactions with queer archives came through my partner, Kate Jinks, who is a film programmer, and she was doing a PhD many years ago on queer documentary or documentation of queer lives on screen. It was through her research that I first sort of saw things like Witches, Faggots, Dykes and Poofters, also some things in North America like Word Is Out, and we visited the Lesbian Herstory Archives. And so that was the first time that I ever saw kind of like queer people in the past, and there was something in that that many years later then kind of like obviously had still sparked a germ of interest that came out in Queer Australia. So, yeah.
And we'll get back to Queer Australia a bit later, but I wanted to stick with early Zoe or pre-Queer Australia Zoe. As a comedian, do you do research for that? I mean, a lot of stand-up seems to be, you know, I saw a banana once and, you know, like it's kind of, you know, the
best description of stand-up that I've ever heard. Yeah, it's true. You know, I saw a banana once.
Yeah, yeah, or that thing about, you know, this, comedians seem to lead off with, you know that thing about pizza?
Yeah.
Or,
you know, eggs. Yeah. You know eggs. Yeah. We all know. You know eggs.
Yeah. So you're supposed to be. But so that makes it seem like it's very off the cuff and it's just come to you and it's being reflective. But how deeply researched are your comedy programs?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I suppose it depends on the kind of comedy. I mean, when I'm writing jokes, I'm always writing. So it's sort of like gathering. I have always thought of joke writing as two processes. And the first one is sort of like foraging, right? You can't kind of just sit down and write a bunch of jokes. There is a writing process where you have to hone the jokes, and it's a very much a, it's a structured writing process. But in order to kind of get those little gems that are like, you know, eggs, I don't know why I've chosen eggs, but you have to grab something when it strikes you. And so I'm constantly keeping notes in my phone of like, oh yeah, funny thing here, or this phrase feels like it could have a different ending, or one of my openers, my most common openers that I've used is what's up cunts, cervixes is the answer. not always, you know, I kind of go, oh, not to be, you know, reductive or transphobic, but, you know, often that's what's up there. That just happened because my friend called me and was like, oh, what's up cunt? And I had that spark. And if I hadn't written it down in that moment, it wouldn't have become a joke. Comedy in itself is kind of a process of archiving and collecting, and it's a sort of a bower birdie type of thing. So there's that aspect. But then in terms of research, like going out and actually actively researching. Dave, for instance, because he's kind of a character and he's a parody, there's a lot of research that's involved in Dave. And certainly in the beginning, I used to write that by just watching really bad clips of comedy on YouTube. And I would just sort of let it roll through and I would be writing while I was listening to that. My background as well is I have like a theatre background, a contemporary performance background. So, and a lot of our work is very heavily researched. So before we write or make anything, we have a very long and intensive research process. And so that will, depending on the topic, will be about just gathering all sorts of little things. And they can be like YouTube videos or academic texts. And there's a real egalitarian type of approach to just gathering anything from any source, and all of those sorts of things then feed into some other picture. And that's my approach with all of those things, I think. I work in lots of different genres, but my approach with every bit of work that I make is to kind of gather a big messy bag of stuff and then try to filter it into something that gives us, in a way, some kind of true whole image of something, but also a unique perspective on it. It's my filter.
That's about the best description of history making I've ever heard. If you liked the banana, I'd like the great big messy grab bag of stuff. And particularly the joining the dots. That's what we do too. That's the processing and the filtering.
Absolutely. Mm. I think there's this idea that there is like a true or right way of doing that. And actually, the process of doing that is constantly changing. It's very alive. It's very specific. There's so many different images that you can make by joining those dots in different ways. And that I find endlessly kind of fascinating. And that can be with, I saw a banana on the street, or it can be with, here's a historical fact, here's a newspaper article from 1932. I'm interested in sort of everything.
I was really struck that you used that word foraging, which is a word that we often use to describe archival research. What does it feel like when you forage and you find those nuggets? Like when your friend rings you up and says, "What's up, cunt?" and you think cervix. Like, what does that moment feel like in your body when you know you've found some gold?
It's very much like striking gold.
Yeah.
It's literally like finding a little jewel on the forest floor, and you have to kind of grab it in that moment. And it feels very special, you know. I think it's the same thing in making Queer Australia, for instance, and going through that. And I'm sure you experience this all the time as historians, that there's something really exciting about finding one piece of interesting information, but when you find the second piece that connects to it and solidifies a theory or shows up a pattern, it's like a real aha kind of moment. You're like, I can't believe this was just lying here.
Does finding the jewel on the forest floor give you the same kind of buzz as getting a laugh on stage? Which is a better high?
Oh, that's a really good question. I mean, they're very much connected. I think it depends on the day, I suppose. Probably getting the laugh, it's a verification of the feeling that you felt before, because often you'll be like, this is an amazing joke, and then you'll go and you'll say it on stage and it bombs and you're like, well, back to the foraging, I was incorrect. And that's what I love about working with an audience as well. That's the whole other thing where, you know, they will tell you if something's funny or not. And there are some things that I will persist with where I'll be like, no, audience, you're wrong. This is funny. And sometimes it does, you just have to tweak a little thing to make it funny. But there is something so special about when you actually find a joke and it works. It's like it's so obvious. You're like, this is so obvious. How has no one made this joke yet? And then sometimes I feel like maybe I've stolen it from someone. And then when you realise, no, this is like a precious little jewel.
So let's go to Queer Australia, where you didn't have a live audience. It's a three-part television show. It's highly curated. I'm assuming that it went through many iterations and forms in the writing phase, and then there's all the editing and everything. So it's very mediated, unlike that situation with your audience. Firstly, how did you feel you made the transition between live response and having to wait, in a sense?
That's an interesting one. I would say I went into this show totally unprepared and as prepared as I could be, but totally blind. Like, I was so clueless. I had never really done anything remotely like this. So the process was a very steep learning curve. But in terms of getting the response from people, my first thought is that I really like working collaboratively, and that when I'm doing solo stand-up, I really do feel like it's a collaboration with the audience. In this case, you know, there were lots of people who were involved in making this, so I am constantly sounding off on their responses of like, does this make sense? Is this funny? Is this interesting? So I kind of feel like that sounding board is still there. But there is something terrifying about making television where the audience isn't there. It's not the first television that I've made. There is that delayed thing, and you have to sort of build up enough of a process. And I am very immersed in my process. I become very obsessed and obsessive. So that kind of takes over. But there is this moment where it goes out where you're like, well, I hope we were right. I mean, you just have to sort of trust. That also exists in stand-up. It's just longer.
Longer time you have to trust the process.
Yeah.
So let's go to the opening scene. The first shot we see in the first episode of Queer Australia, you are opening an archive box and you are pulling out a document. And then we pull back and we see this whole main set, and you've got photographs and posters and maps and newspaper cuttings, and it looks like one of those kind of detective crime scene reconstruction inspo board.
That was one of the really early ideas, that it's really just a visual manifestation of my brain. But also the way, you know, what we were saying before about it's about connecting the dots, and it's a very understandable kind of way of creating somewhat linear connections with something that is quite non-linear, you know, and demonstrating to the audience, well, we're going to be going in all sorts of different directions, like a brainstorm, murder wall situation. So that was one of the earliest ideas, and that was one of the things that the ABC, when we were pitching the idea, that they were like, oh, we get that. That's the other thing with this. I like complicated stuff. I like things to be sort of messy and go all over the place, but there needs to be a real method to that, otherwise it's just chaos. And then we got very late kind of in the stage, once we were in production, then it was about using the images that we had clearance for, which is a whole other thing, and working with a set designer then sort of brought that to life.
So don't pitch to ABC executives that you want to set your comedy series or your history series in a library. Say you want to set it at a murder wall.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there were other practical things as well, that it needed to be a very active space. It needed to be something that could sort of shift and we could move through. We always wanted it to be like a bit of a magic space, so the doors can open to different places and stuff can come out of boxes. And a lot of it is just visual as well. So working with the DOP, Ben Lindbergh, who was really amazing, and then Stamatia Maroupas, who was my main collaborator in this, who was the director. So just working out that we wanted it to be really kind of alive and full of possibility.
As you've already said, Zoe, that...
Okay, I'm gonna narrate this here. We are laughing because we've queered the documentary space here today by inviting Eve's grown dog, Zelda...
She's very large,
sitting on their lap and was just licking the microphone.
Yeah. It was really perfectly timed. Well done, Zelda.
Zoe, so as you said, Queer Australia has like a non-linear structure. You're not kind of going from 1788 to the present. And you talk about this as a looping meta-narrative where you ask the question again and again, you know, where does this story begin? And we have all these various beginnings. This non-linear relationship to time strikes me as being very queer, indeed. And just to get really nerdy for a second, my favourite queer theorist, Jack Halberstam, has argued that queering time is foundational to queerness itself.
Queer temporality.
Queer temporalities, oh, you're all over it. He said that at its heart, to be queer is to experience strange temporalities. So was that like part of your thinking process in building up the structure of Queer Australia, that non-linear temporalities are queer and we need it for a queer history?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think it comes from a very kind of genuine, authentic place for me. Oh. That is, I think it's how a lot of us experience the world, actually. I mean, I feel like linear narrative structures are made up and imposed. They're not actually how we experience time or memory or any of those things. So, or meaning as well, because I think often... making television or theatre is very, it can be very focused on this like linear story, and that it's about how do we make the story make sense. I'm not so interested in story, actually. I'm not really interested in narrative. What I'm interested in is the meaning behind it. If a narrative story is the way to get to that meaning, great. But it's not the purpose for me. I mean, that's also how I experience the world. I think it probably has a lot to do with having ADHD as well. But I think it is a very queer thing. And it's interesting, again, when you're pitching a TV show to like network executives, it doesn't work that well to bring up like theories of queer temporality.
Yeah, I can imagine that would have been a bit abstract.
But you kind of have to go like, so you have to find different ways to sort
eyes
of
glaze over,
and
people start looking at watches.
Yeah. So you go, it's like a, you know, it's a murder wall. It's like non-linear. So we'll jump around. Yeah, just sort of saying it's a queer way of storytelling, I suppose, is the simplified version of that. I also think it's really important, actually. It's not just an aesthetic thing. It's about creating spaces to tell those stories that don't fit into a neat structure, you know, because those structures come from a very kind of hierarchical, patriarchal way of telling stories. There's an agenda to a narrative structure. And it's not by accident that we get left out of those stories. Mm. It's by design. And so we can't really truthfully tell different stories by using those same structures. I really believe that, you know. It's also boring.
So one of the other things that you do to kind of bend the narrative, to make it not straight in that way, is that you talk back to the narrator. So it's like you heckle your own disembodied voice of authority. What was with that?
I mean, it was a bit of fun. It became a comic foil. A little behind the scenes is that the narrator is actually based on Stamatia, the director. So, which became like
so
a
you're
running...
mocking your own director.
Yeah, she will hate this. But often we would be in the edit together, and we worked very much, very involved with the editors all the way through all that decision making. And so often we would be in the room and Stan would say, like, you can't say that, or like, that doesn't make any sense. And I'd write a response to it and then I would record a voiceover. So it was sort of happening in real time. I think the thing is, I think we need to reimagine and sort of reject those existing structures of storytelling, but you can't throw them out altogether because it's the way that we've all been trained to. Oh, Zelda. She agrees.
Yeah.
Throw it out.
But it's the way that we understand, like, what's happening next and what are you telling me about what to expect or not. So it was a way of having that structure there is a really important part of it, to tell people what's going on, but also to undermine it and to tell people, oh, we're going to be having fun with this. So it's kind of performing a bunch of different functions. And sometimes they just need to tell us what's going on.
Almost more heretical is that you talk back to the archives. So there are times where, like, you verbally joust with a quote from the 17th century. So the disembodied voice of authority narrator will read, in, you know, Ken Burns style, the quote from some 17th century journal, and then you'll mock it.
Yeah, yeah. The way that we sort of had to frame it always was like, it's me engaging with it. So I could never be a voice of authority. So I suppose it's again about, like, just creating different ways of looking at it.
You also have the archives talking back to the archives. I just thought this was brilliant, where you'll have a bit of archival television footage that will act as its own witty riposte to something somebody else has said in another bit of archival footage. It's all very irreverent, which is what's so gorgeous about it. As you said, it's not boring. So many history documentaries that we see just are frankly boring. I'm wondering whether you used your, but I'm not an historian, as a kind of get out of jail free card.
Oh, 100%. The version of myself that I play in the show is like a few decimal points dumber than I am in real life, I think. But it was a way of saying, like, this is our approach where I'm not the authority, but it was important that there was reverence and there was weight given when it needed to be. So I think that personal approach is something that was really important in that as well. There's no way you can do a definitive, well, arguably there's no way you can do a definitive history of anything, but certainly not of the entire queer history of Australia.
There must have been stories you wanted to tell that you just couldn't fit in 3 episodes.
Oh my God, so many.
Can you give us a bit of a glimpse of what was left on the cutting room floor?
Oh my God, there's so much, so much. There were interviews that we did. People. There was a whole section on sport and some of that is in there, like Ian Roberts is still in there and Ricky Coughlin is in there as well, who was a trans athlete in the sort of 90s. She's in there, but not so much talking about sport. And we talked a lot about sport as well in your interview.
We talked
a bunch about sport. So.
Okay, spoiler alert, listeners, Eve is in this documentary too.
We talked a ton about sport and, like, what it meant for the Australian, you know.
I had totally forgotten that, but we did.
Yeah, so that was a whole section. We did an interview with Bev Francis, who's at one point was the strongest woman in the world and was in 1980s bodybuilding movies. She was in, like, the Arnold Schwarzenegger bodybuilding movie. It was like Pumping Iron.
Yeah.
And then there's Pumping Iron 2, The Women. And Bev Francis is this Australian bodybuilder who there were lots of lesbian rumours around her. She's very butch. She's actually bisexual, married a man who's in the film. But we interviewed Bev and we had this whole sort of feature on Bev. And then in the end, we cut the sports thing. So I had to cut Bev.
Oh,
sorry,
no.
Bev. And she was really incredible. But it just, for time, we just couldn't fit that in. And we were sort of covering that overarching Australian identity thing a little bit more with, like, the Anzacs and those stories kind of took over a little bit more. So there were things like that as well. So many, so many stories.
Do you know whether this is the first Australian documentary to use all queer talking head interviewees?
I would hazard a guess.
Probably.
Surely. Yeah.
I'm wondering whether the choice of interviewees relate to another one of your killer lines, also your killer insights, and I'm going to quote here. It's worth remembering that, historically, heterosexual white historians physically cannot see lesbians. It's a physiological anomaly where two butch women on motorbikes can be kissing in front of them and they'll say, look at those poor spinsters. So it's almost like you could have called this show Queer Eye for the Straight Historian.
Yeah.
Were you trying to make the point that it's not just about what is in the archive, but who is, in a sense, capable of seeing what's in the archive?
Oh, absolutely. As soon as you start looking at any kind of queer history, it's the questions come up of, you know, can you call that person queer? Or how do we know when they might not have identified as that and whatever? I mean, most of the time a lot of the time you can know pretty well. You're like, yeah, they seem pretty, they seem to be telling us as much as they can they're queer. But often you really don't know. But I think the bigger thing there is I was really like, I don't really care. It doesn't matter. What matters more is the way that we look at it and the sorts of stories that we're telling through history. I was as interested in that as the stories themselves.
Well, one of the things that you make very clear in the first episode is that being queer is a process of discovery in itself. It's a process of piecing together bits and pieces of information, traces of evidence about alternative ways of being and living. So I'm wondering whether, generalizations aside, all queer people are in some way kind of organic historians looking for traces of themselves.
It's really interesting that you say that because a lot of the people that we spoke to, some of them obviously were historians, such as Eve. So that's kind of built in, but a lot of people are these kind of citizen archivists. We had people like Julie Peters who has done exactly what you've just described. She's spent years kind of gathering these little pieces of archive, ways of explaining herself to herself, then keeping it as like, I'm real, I belong, you know, this is where I fit in. And there's lots of people like that. Peter DeWaal has done the same sort of thing. Lots of queer people are collectors and archivists because no one's done it for us. It's interesting. I think there's something also in what you just said there about alternative ways of living, right? And I think that's what really interests me because I think there's something at its heart of queerness is about challenging the status quo by your mere existence. And so that's why I think when looking at stories like the Lady Squatters, for instance, we don't have any evidence that these women were lesbians or that they had sex or whatever. It doesn't really matter. What we're seeing is two people who, by all the facts of their lives, kind of went against everything that was expected of women.
So it's still queer whether they're like having sex or not, really.
It really
is. They're living in a queer way.
They're living in this sort of marriage-like relationship that's not heterosexual, and it's really interesting to kind of go, we haven't been told that story, and how does that fit into what we know about ourselves?
Did it change your relationship to your own queerness, like learning all this history?
I got very sick of saying the word queer. And
how queer?
I started joking throughout. Well, actually, we all did. We're like, I'm straight now. Like, we had a mostly queer team, and it was like, I think we're all straight now. Wow. You know, we found a cure. It's really expensive, but the ABC can fund it.
Okay. This is the conversion therapy we've been looking for.
Conversion therapy that we needed all along. Just make a documentary about it.
So you employ a lot of humour in the program, obviously, because you're a comedian, not an historian. And we've done a lot of laughing today, but there's a serious project underlying your storytelling. There's a very serious intent. And you're showing us that in no uncertain documentary terms, that from the first days of colonisation in Australia, there was what you call a profound bedrock of homophobia to build a nation on. Turns out discovery can be dark as well as enlightening. Were there moments in making this show, in joining these dots, that led you to some grim places emotionally?
Oh, absolutely. A lot of the stories themselves are really sad and they're really dark. You know, you're seeing people who, yes, had really interesting lives, but they are discovered or whatever and their identity is their downfall. You know, they come to these kind of quite tragic ends. And you see that a lot. We have a really dark history. And then, of course, you're looking at things like the AIDS crisis, which is absolutely sort of devastating. And it's really hard to look at that stuff. It's also really hard then to go, okay, how do I honour this and tell this story? pretty much everyone that I interviewed, there's some relationship to trauma in most queer people. I would include myself in that as well. That is the serious part of the project, of like trying to work that out and how do we do that. But at the same time, there's so much humor. Like, it's also how we have processed it a lot of the time. So that was really important as well. I think the biggest thing for me is probably a positive one. There's a bleakness to it as well, but seeing the patterns that occur throughout history, I mean, we're in a moment of backlash right now, but it's really interesting to sort of look at that in a historical context and go, this has happened before and it will happen again. It's actually the same sort of thing
it's
that
repeats.
Cyclical.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is the one that we're in right now. It just sort of slightly changes its focus. You know, and right now there's a lot of focus on trans people, and that is like this kind of thing that sort of is quite scary and is blowing up around the world. It gives you an interesting perspective. That was the big thing for me, of going like, okay, can see a bit more of the picture.
Sadly, and on that not particularly funny note, we are going to have to wind this up. But Zoe, we couldn't let you go without asking you the question that we ask everybody here at Archives Anonymous in our safe space. Do you have a dirty little archive secret that you would like to share with us?
Oh, I've got so many that I can't share with you on air, but I'll tell you in the courtyard later. Things fall into your hands that may not come throughout the regular...
They fell off the back of a truck.
They fall off the back of an archive truck sometimes. But my personal one, and I feel this is important archive work, I take photos of every time I see a vomit on the street. Every single time. I don't look at them. I don't, like, keep them in a folder or anything. I just feel compelled to, because no one else is going to.
Wow.
The hidden history that's being ignored.
I know. That's my next pick. ABC.
Wait, how long ago did you start doing this?
I don't know. Years ago. And then this is the terrible thing, though. Recently,
oh, you lost them. Yeah.
You know how your phone makes, like, videos?
Oh, of all the photos and one thing. Like,
and it just brings it back to you with
so,
that.
And your
it
phone made, one made the vomit compilation.
The vomit, and it was called Bon Appetit.
With that slight porn music behind it?
Yes.
Oh, nice.
I have noticed on your Instagram your management's pushing you to put up more reels of your work. Maybe that's the reel that needs to go up. Bon Appetit.
Bon Appetit. Yeah, I should put it up. It's pretty good.
I want to see it. The world needs to see it.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
So, Zoe with the murder board in her head, thank you for joining
us
today.
And the vomit on her phone.
And the vomit on her phone, archiving ephemera. I'm going to enjoy watching where that archive turns up. Who's going to acquire that archive?
It's very
important.
Keep
it for all time.
The National Library, obviously.
Oh, yeah, NSFA. I can recall.
Obviously. But I'm afraid we're clean out of time. So thank you so much for joining us, Zoe. It's been a real treat to have you here today.
To learn more about Zoe's work, don't bother checking out her website because it's too ridiculous, but it is zoecoombsmar.com, or follow her on Instagram at zoecoombsmar. Please, please, please watch Queer Australia on ABC iView if you haven't already, and check out Bossy Bottom on Amazon Prime.
And you can follow Eve on Instagram at EveRees.
And you can follow Claire on Twitter at Claire A. Wright, or on Instagram at Claire Wright Historian. Don't forget, you can catch up on all of seasons 1, 2, 3, and 4 via the website archivefeverpod.com.
So until our next therapeutic session, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees.
And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast recorded and produced by Matt Smith on unceded Wurundjeri land.
Our theme music is by Poddington Bear. You can hear more at soundofpicture.com.
Coming up on the next episode...
It's actually the investigation part of it that I think really intrigues me. And that does definitely link to being a lawyer, exploring the ways in which as a defence lawyer, because that's what I've always done, you find ways to explain your client's story, which really can lead to people being found not guilty of crimes that they're not guilty of. So there's a justice outcome at the end of it.